From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And this morning, members of Congress received a classified briefing on, what else, Russia. And a few hours before that, President-elect Donald Trump tweeted that it was a failed spy and sleazebag political operatives who put out what he called the fake news that Russia has damaging information on him. That retired spy, who gathered intelligence first for Republicans against Trump, then Democrats, has reportedly gone into hiding. So once again, Russian intrigue in the week in the news.
We really need to name our political roundup something with a Russian word, I think. Joining us today from Miami, Maria Elena Salinas, news anchor at Univision. Hi, Maria Elena.
Hi, good to talk to both of you.
Great to have you. And from Des Moines, Iowa, Kay Henderson, news director at Radio Iowa. Hi, Kay.
Greetings.
And we will get to the Russia stuff, but we also had so many hearings this week for Trump's cabinet nominees, and a lot of them got to that issue of Russia. This morning, Trump tweeted, "All of my cabinet nominees are looking good and doing a great job. I want them to be themselves and express their own thoughts, not mine," referring to the fact that many of them had broken with him on different issues. Kay, are any of them at this point, does it look like, in danger of not being confirmed?
It appears that the Secretary of State nominee, Mr. Tillerson, would be the one that is in the most precarious position, of course, because of the way that Marco Rubio, a member of the committee, questioned him and specifically about Aleppo.
In Syria. But he would get to the point of Russia because many of them differed with him. They said they felt that Russia was not a friend, that Putin was not to be trusted. They believed that there had been hacking. Maria Elena very much differed with Trump.
Exactly. You know, these confirmation hearings, I think, are great forums for senators to show that they can ask the tough questions. It's sort of like a showcase. But, you know, the important thing is that the American people get to know them a little bit better. And it's interesting how they were all asked if they would agree with the president or if they would be willing to go against his will. And most of them said yes. In fact, many of them have distanced themselves from some of Trump's more radical positions and statements. So that kind of tells you a lot about the doubt in the Senate, in the Senate committee, about the president's judgment.
It sort of puts a new angle on the whole team of rivals concept.
Right.
These may be rivals within rather than rivals of Trump.
Well, but he has been said to, want to stir it up in his businesses, so maybe in his cabinet as well. Well, also this week, the Justice Department's internal watchdog announced an investigation into FBI Director James Comey's reinvestigation of Hillary Clinton's unverified emails during the election, something that was disclosed, as opposed to the unverified reports that Russians, colluded with the Trump campaign and had damaging information on him. That was not disclosed, even though people knew about it during the election. So I want to play this exchange in a congressional hearing Tuesday. You have Maine Senator Angus King pressing the FBI Director Comey about whether the FBI was investigating the Russian information.
Especially in a public forum, we never confirm or deny a pending investigation.
The irony of your making that statement here, I cannot avoid, but I'll move on.
Well, we sometimes think differently about closed investigations, but he asked me if I had any pending investigations, and we're not going to talk about that.
The point there, King, saying, wait a second, you disclosed Clinton's emails. And look, today the Wall Street Journal called for Comey to resign. But do you think, Kay, take this, will a new Trump Justice Department allow this investigation into Comey's public handling of the emails, which could have made a difference in the election that they won?
Well, the relationship between Donald Trump and Comey has been rocky through the fall. So there was some question about whether Comey would stay on in the Trump administration if it would be so untenable that he would have to resign. So I think this just complicates the relationship. And of course, I remember the day that that letter from Comey came out, Hillary Clinton was in Des Moines campaigning, and it took her campaign hours to figure out how to respond to that public statement from Comey.
We were on the air live talking about it when it happened. And by the way, this was also the week that Donald Trump gave his first press conference in months, and it was extremely combative. Maria Elena, what does that tell you about how Trump is going to do his job as president, how he responds to criticism, and how the media should be approaching him?
Well, there's one thing that's clear. There's no difference between Donald Trump, the candidate, and Donald Trump, the president-elect. He showed that he will not tolerate anyone who doesn't agree with him. You know, I'm personally concerned with how he's handling the media. It's an affront to freedom of speech to shut down a reporter and not allow him to ask questions, to denigrate a reporter and accuse media outlets of spreading fake news.
Well, and in fact, your colleague Jorge Ramos experienced that back during the campaign. He was kicked out of a press conference, but then he was brought back in by Trump after other members of the media complained. In this case,
I know,
when he went after CNN, it was not like that.
Right. But it was interesting how at the time people accused my co-anchor Jorge of grandstanding and of being rude to Trump and interrupting him when he was in his press conference. And now we're talking about, you know, a violation of freedom of the press. One thing that we do know is that Sean Spicer told Jim Acosta afterwards, he told him that if you do that again, you know, we're going to kick you out of the press conference. So, you know, it is a dangerous thing when no one knows what to believe, when you undermine your institutions, when you put into question the media and the institutions. You know, that happens in third world countries or in authoritarian countries where no one trusts their institutions, the media censored. But it's not supposed to happen in our democracy.
Well, you know, something else happened there. I just want to ask you, we'll move on from the press conference, but Kay Henderson, maybe take this. A columnist here in Boston, Yvonne Abraham, picked up on this. He was, of course, very dismissive of the unverified reports that his campaign colluded with the Russians and that the Russians had, in fact, entrapped him, had salacious video on him, again, completely unverified. And he was very angry and he said, does anybody think that I know about cameras. Did anybody think? And also made a comment about, by the way, I'm also a germaphobe, so I wouldn't be doing anything salacious. This is the same guy who was caught on a camera that he could see talking to Billy Bush about grabbing women in places that if you're a germaphobe, perhaps you shouldn't. It was also an entertaining moment. Kay Henderson, is that what we're going to see? Somebody who, you know, maybe is twisting what he's said in the past, but it's appealing.
Well, I'm not wearing my Nattering Nabobs of Negativism T-shirt today, but I would say that a friend of mine overheard a Hillary Clinton voter at a restaurant recently after the press conference actually praising Trump for the way he put the press down. So I think that the press has a lot to prove to the public when it comes to Donald Trump, and Trump is capitalizing on that. Mm.
This was also a week in which President Obama kind of said goodbye. I mean, we will probably hear more from him over the next several days, but he is saying his farewell as president. And also, there was a very sweet moment yesterday when he had a heartfelt tribute to Joe Biden, the vice president at the White House, and surprised Biden by awarding him the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Let's listen.
For the first and only time in my presidency, I will bestow this medal with an additional level of veneration, an honor my three most recent successors reserved for only three others, Pope John Paul II, President Ronald Reagan, and General Colin Powell. Ladies and gentlemen, I am proud to award the Presidential Medal of Freedom with distinction to my brother, Joseph Robinette Biden, Jr.
Maria Elena, there are, of course, a lot of people in this country that have, you know, it's a very divided country right now, but there are many people who are really going to miss both President Obama and Vice President Biden.
I know. I think it was very emotional. Obama's speech, of course, in Chicago, where he came full circle in the place where he began. You know, he's all about symbolism. And that very special relationship between Joe Biden and President Obama. You know, I've heard a lot of people criticize Obama's policies, but you hear very little criticizing his persona and the type of relationship that he has, his family life and his relationship with Joe Biden. I mean, I've interviewed them both. I have been at events with both of them. They are very close and they do have a very special relationship. It's funny. Last night I was watching CNN and they were talking about this very subject and someone said that maybe Joe Biden will go down as the first African-American vice president because he's so close and he's got that, you know, that very close relationship, you know, my brother from another mother.
I just want to ask, what else might we see at the end of the Obama administration? Presidential pardons, you know, people are asking, can Chelsea Manning be pardoned in prison now for leaking information to WikiLeaks when WikiLeaks was so intrusive in the election? Kay Henderson, you know, thoughts about in the few days, it's what, 3-4 days, Jeremy?
A week, basically.
Yeah, a week. what might we see?
Well, I do think we'll see more pardons, and in particular, President Obama has been sending out batches of pardons, sometimes over 100 at a time, of people who have been incarcerated under drug enforcement laws that many are criticizing and that, frankly, Congress is looking at changing because of the changes that were made during the quote-unquote war on drugs. So I would expect there to be dozens, if not hundreds, of pardons of people who are incarcerated in federal prisons.
Mm-hmm. You know, who does want a pardon is the dreamers. It's those young immigrants who were brought here when they were children and are protected under Obama's executive order under DACA. And there's a huge danger that that might disappear. Jeff Sessions, if he does get confirmed, he has personally said that he thinks that it should not continue, that it should be canceled. So
a pardon might also
a pardon would be very nice for these thousands of dreamers.
Maria Elena Salinas at Univision and Kay Henderson at Radio Iowa will be watching in this last week of the Obama administration. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Did you see when the power outage interrupted the Senate confirmation hearing for Kansas Rep. Mike Pompeo to lead the CIA? There was also this moment on C-SPAN's online feed yesterday when California Democrat Maxine Waters was testifying on the House floor.
At this time, with a bill that would basically take our cop on the block, the SEC, and literally obliterate.
Well, that was obliterated by a commercial on RT, the state-run Russian TV network. C-SPAN spokesman says its website was interrupted by RT for about 10 minutes. They think it was an internal routing issue, but that's not what social media thinks. Let's bring in Femi Oke, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English in Washington. Hi, Femi.
Hello there, Robin.
And this is also the week of those unverified reports of Russian spying on Donald Trump and Donald Trump acknowledging that Russia hacked the DNC. Everyone's into conspiracy theories on social media anyway, so these outages must have put people over the top.
Oh, my goodness. If you were on Twitter, you would have thought it was the end of all times as far as Russia and the U.S. concerned. So John Arovosis, he's from the At America blog. He said, so today, a congressional hearing mysteriously loses power and somehow, think of air quotes when he says somehow, C-SPAN is taken over by the Russian propaganda network. And then the plot thickens, Robin, because shortly after that interruption happened on C-SPAN, Jisor Simasor noticed that after RT.com was cut into a C-SPAN broadcast earlier today, they are now down for, again, those air quotes, maintenance.
Aha!
Cyber wars much? Question mark?
Well, look, C-SPAN monitors other channels for breaking news. Everybody
Indeed.
Does that. NPR does that. And RT is one of the channels they were monitoring. But even Maxine Waters, you know, she spoke to the New York Times. What did she say?
While I am on the floor of the House, says Maxine Waters, talking about Trump and Russia, I get interfered with and interrupted by Russia today. It's strange. It's odd.
Okay. Let's see.
But C-SPAN does say, if you look at the top of C-SPAN's tweet, it's pinned right there for our notice and our attention. They say we don't believe that we were hacked.
Yeah. All right. We'll leave that at that. Look, Linda Bean, who serves on the board of her family's L.L. Bean, has been a big topic on social media. We mentioned this yesterday. She apparently contributed over the limit to a pro-Donald Trump PAC, so it got reported. But she defended herself on Fox News, Fox and Friends yesterday. She says her cousin, who was L.L. Bean's CEO at the time, donated to President Obama 4 years ago. There was no outcry.
It's a double standard. And, you know, they're victimized. Both these guys won. Obama won, and Trump won. My cousin's candidate, my candidate.
Your cousin.
But I'm the one that's being targeted and vilified and asked to be taken off the board.
Again, it was reported and made a big deal of because apparently she over-contributed. But there's now a hashtag, grab your wallets. It's boycotting companies that support Donald Trump. And Donald Trump is tweeting a thank you to Linda Bean and telling people to buy L.L. Bean. What else has been happening online?
Well, if you go to L.L. Bean, at L.L. Bean on Twitter, you'll find that they have a pinned tweet, a statement on Facebook saying that we do not get involved in politics, that Linda Bean made a personal contribution. There are over 50 members of the Bean family who are involved in the company, and they stay out of politics. Now, underneath that pinned tweet was a ferocious Twitter war going on between supporters of Trump and people who are critical of Trump. Let me share one tweet, give you an example from Southern Mama. She says, "Thank you, LL Bean. Please don't allow yourself to be bullied." Dennis Hughes asks for, "Where can I get a catalogue?" And then Against the Voices says, "Great company. I never shopped with you before. I'm going to start shopping with you now." And then, of course, there's all the normal Trump pushback underneath that. So a Twitter war going underneath that tweet. Well, LL Bean is saying, "We are not publicly supporting Trump or against him. This was a personal family member's decision."
Look, they have that boot that some of us have been wearing for like our entire lives that suddenly hit about a year ago and got so insanely popular. We hear there's still like 50,000 back orders behind in this fabulous LL Bean boot. So it's probably not going to make too much of a dent right now for them. Femi Oke, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English, taking a look at how the news is filtering through social media this week. Femi, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, on Sunday, HBO will premiere a show about an unpredictable hardliner taking over one of the most important institutions in the world. He can seem arrogant sometimes, needy at other times, and he's a master at keeping his opponents off balance. No, it has nothing to do with Donald Trump. I'm talking about the show The Young Pope, which is about a young American man, played by Jude Law, who is handed the reins to the Vatican and all of Catholicism. Diane Keaton plays the nun who raised him. In this scene, he speaks to a room full of cardinals.
"From this day forward, everything that was wide open is going to be closed. Evangelization, we've already done it. Ecumenicalism, been there, done that. Tolerance doesn't live here anymore. It's been evicted. It vacated the house for the new tenant who has diametrically opposite tastes in decorating."
Well, joining us now is NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
And what do you think about this show, The Young Pope?
Well, it's an interesting project. So this is a show that's already aired overseas, and it's a co-production of Italian, British, and American media companies. It was created by this Italian filmmaker, Paolo Sorrentino. He's an Oscar winner for a foreign language film. And so the series looks amazing. It's really well shot and composed. It definitely has a filmic quality in the production. But the story doesn't really hang together for me, and it almost doesn't make a lot of sense. You know, we're presented with a situation in this show where an American is named Pope, and not only an American is named Pope, but a young American is named Pope. And there's very little explanation given to how the politics of that worked out. I mean, it was considered unusual for the current Pope, who has a Latin American heritage, to be elected to the job. So a lot about it doesn't make sense, and a lot about it doesn't speak to sort of the current political realities of the church, because it's so busy looking beautiful and delivering these powerful scenes. But all that said, it is a really interesting project, and I wouldn't be surprised if it develops some fans here in America when it starts airing on HBO. It's already been a hit overseas.
Should we be concerned that the American Pope is being played by a British actor?
Well, that's one of the things that's so weird about it.
They couldn't find anybody in Hollywood, I guess.
You know, and as you can hear, I mean, Jude Law does a great job playing an American. But I also feel like there's a sense, and maybe I'm prejudiced because I know that the writer and the director of it is not American, but I don't really get a sense of the Americanness of this character. Like, why does it matter that he's American? What does he bring about being an American? On the one hand, we have the sense that he's very conservative. You can hear in that speech that, you know, this is a pope that is counter to the kind of pope that we have, the kind of inclusive pope that we have now in real life. But I'm not quite sure what they're trying to say by making an American pope. But as I said, it's beautiful looking. And, you know, it's been a hit overseas. You know, the British seem to love it. It did well in Italy. But I think in America, it's going to be a bit more of a challenge.
Now, you're joining us from Los Angeles today because you've been out there for the Golden Globes. La La Land, a big winner out there. The Night Manager, which I'm almost done with. another big winner at the Golden Globes.
You're really running late, man. The Night Manager aired six or seven or eight months ago. You got to catch up,
I know. And I did finish Westworld, so that's good, too. But you know, the big moment of that Golden Globe ceremony was Meryl Streep's speech where she called out Donald Trump. What did you think of that night?
Well, you know, it's interesting because there was a lot of concern, I think, amongst artists and people in Hollywood that once Trump was elected president, they would feel like there was this enormous pressure from the country to toe the line and to go along with whatever his administration wanted to do. And I think instead what we've seen is a recommitment to people standing up for ideals that they believe in and trying to make sure that this new administration recognizes diversity and inclusion and standing up for people who are marginalized in society. And I think Meryl Streep did a good job of sort of articulating those ideas. Once again, where Hollywood sometimes falls short is in recognizing that there are people who may not be considered, you know, patrons of the arts, who might not go to a Broadway show or might not go to the opera, but who also value those ideals. And so I think, again, where Meryl Streep may have made a bit of a miscalculation and where a lot of people in Hollywood have made a miscalculation is in assuming that just because people like certain kinds of entertainment, they don't have the same values about humanity that they do. And so the line in her speech where she sort of talked about how mixed martial arts isn't art.
Isn't the arts.
I mean, in the strictest sense, she's right. But it was a jab at people who might have actually been on her side until she insulted something they value. And so in a weird way, her speech sort of really illuminated the issues of the moment in both a good and bad way.
NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joining us from Los Angeles. And Eric, I promise I'm going to be right in the front of the line on Homeland, which also starts this weekend, the new season. So I won't be talking to you about it in 6 months. But thank you so much for joining us.
I'm going to be testing you, my friend. So you better catch up quick.
The U.S. Justice Department released their report today on the Chicago Police Department, saying the Chicago Police Department regularly use excessive force against people who live in the city's predominantly black neighborhoods. Attorney General Loretta Lynch made the announcement this morning.
These are serious problems, and they bear serious consequences for all Chicagoans. And as I said when I announced this investigation, the systems and policies that fail ordinary citizens also fail the vast majority of Chicago Police Department officers who risk their lives every day to serve and protect the people of Chicago.
The Justice Department began its investigation after police released a dash cam video of the 2014 death of Laquan McDonald, a black teenager who was walking away from police when a white officer shot him 16 times. Joining us now is Patrick Smith, who's been following the story for WBEZ in Chicago. And Patrick, a lot in this report today. What else was in it?
Well, what else is in it? A lot of it does focus specifically on the use of force, but there's a lot of details about how that force is being used. The Department of Justice found that officers in Chicago shoot at fleeing suspects who are presenting no immediate threat. They shoot at vehicles with no justification. They use tasers against people for doing nothing more than just not following verbal commands. And what's also in there is what the Department of Justice believes is the cause of all this, which is very inadequate training and inadequate supervision by the Chicago Police Department as an institution.
Now, Mayor Rahm Emanuel was under pressure to respond after the dash cam video originally came out. He fired the police superintendent last year, and he was alongside the attorney general today. Let's listen.
The incidents described in this report are sobering to all of us. Police misconduct will not be tolerated anywhere in the city of Chicago, and those who break the rules will be held accountable for their actions.
What kind of steps is Chicago now going to take, or do we know, because of this report?
Well, part of the announcement today, besides the findings in this big report, was an agreement in principle between the Department of Justice and the City of Chicago. That is to say that Mayor Rahm Emanuel and some other people from the city signed off on having a federal consent decree and an independent monitor. That doesn't mean that that's already in place. What they agreed to today is that in the future, they will go to the court along with the Department of Justice and agree to have an independent monitor. It's similar, actually, to what happened in Baltimore. You know, they had an agreement in principle last summer. And then just yesterday, as everyone knows, they announced that there's going to be a consent decree. I don't know if the timeline will be the same, but that's what the city has agreed to do in the future.
And in Chicago specifically, we've heard so much about all of the violence that's been going on in Chicago. Do people believe that that is related to what's at issue here in this report?
I think people absolutely do. Attorney General Lynch today talked a lot about the fact that while they were doing this report, there was this very, very troubling and big spike in violent crime in Chicago. And she said that is very much connected to the fact that there's no trust between the residents in the communities that have all this violence and the police officers who are supposed to protect them and prevent the violence. She said that these reforms don't go against crime fighting. They will eventually make crime fighting easier.
That's WBEZ's Patrick Smith joining us from Chicago. Patrick, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
The explosion of the local food movement created an equal explosion of independent chef-run restaurants, casual spaces that serve upscale pub food at a price point usually in between the fine dining special occasion sit-down restaurants and fast food takeout joints. It's made it easy for people in cities to get good quality house-made food in a sit-down restaurant any night of the week. But Kevin Alexander says that golden age of restaurants is about to end. His piece in the online magazine Thrillist is called "There's a Massive Restaurant Industry Bubble and It's About to Burst." He joins us. Kevin Alexander, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And we know this is the last piece in a year-long investigative series you've written about the restaurant industry, but stay with this notion that this is a bubble. Make your case.
Basically, what we've seen is sort of the golden age of restaurants, and it's from what I think is 2006 to 2016. And during that golden age, all of these restaurants that you talked about, the ones with the similar aesthetic, the reclaimed wood and the Edison bulbs and the mismatched chairs, that vibe, the fine dining trained chef who wants to take that experience and do something more casual, all of that, that became sort of the signature restaurant of this era. And the good part of that is diners got more informed, local foods, all of that. The bad side of that is the economics on it just don't work anymore. And that's a lot of factors here, but some of the main ones are rising labor costs, rent increases, a huge glut of similar restaurants, a shortage of cooks, and just customers not willing to pay the higher prices. So I think all of that sort of contributed to this bubble. And we're starting to see signs that it's bursting.
Okay. Take the thing that probably just set off ding, ding alarms for a lot of people because it's such a buzz phrase and it's so controversial right now. Rising labor costs. This is the move to pay the people who support the restaurant industry, the people in the back of the house, a living wage. And wages have gone up across the country in different states recently. Are you saying that this noble experiment in paying people to actually do the dirty work of feeding America, are you saying that it's that living wage that's taking the restaurant industry down?
Well, it's not taking the restaurant industry down. It's changing the restaurant industry. And I think it's very important for us to note that this is good. You know, our wage workers are usually the lowest earners, and this increase is essential in ensuring they actually earn a living. But it's nonetheless an additional cost that must be factored in. And a lot of these restaurants don't have those costs factored in. So when you increase these wages, if you're a restaurant that's sort of been struggling to make it and all of a sudden your costs go up 10, 15%, that means the difference between staying open and closing. And so we're seeing with those wage increases, a lot of these places just end up closing.
Well, you point to one restaurant in San Francisco, AQ, where their costs for health benefits went from $14,000 per year to $86,000 per year.
Yeah, over the course of at AQ, the restaurant that I profile in the piece in San Francisco, in 2012 they paid $14,400 for healthcare, and in 2015 they paid $86,000. So, you know, that's $72,000 more, if my math is correct, than 2012, and that's, you know, 29% of their best year's profits. would just sort of wiped away from there.
Yeah. Well, look, there's been pushback on this notion. Just last week, Forbes reported that the minimum wage increase in Seattle hasn't resulted in fewer restaurant jobs, that the city's restaurant industry is growing.
Yes.
You're chuckling.
I am chuckling because we are still in the bubble. You know, I wrote this story because I traveled around. I visited 19 cities and I really saw the effects that it was having. And I talked to chefs. And during these bubbles, you kind of don't know it's over until it's really, really over. Now, let me also say there's another crucial factor here that's sort of propping up the bubble, and it's outside money coming into the restaurant industry. So, you know, during this sort of golden age, being an investor in a restaurant became cool. So there's a lot of sort of false money being, and it's not false money, it's actual money, but it's propping it up in a very false way.
Well, and not just the restaurants, but the competitors to the restaurants. You write about food delivery apps that, you know, they can afford to lose money because they're also sustained by investors and they're taking service away from restaurants.
Yes, and especially the types of places, sort of like Munchery, where they're making the food in-house. You know, some of these places, the restaurants contribute, and they're just sort of delivery services or whatever. We want to distinguish between them. But for a lot of those places, they're, you know, with the millennial generation, it's an app on your phone, and you don't want to deal with going to a restaurant or facing someone and talking to them. You just hit it, and you get this food. And you get it at a really cheap price. And if that happens to take 10% of the revenue from a local sit-down restaurant, that's a massive hit and could be the difference between staying open or shutting down.
What else is cutting into restaurants in your view?
Well, I think the biggest issue is really the glut of similarities. And it's just there's too many. And I think the most remarkable statistic that I found during the story was in discussing in San Francisco. In 2011, when AQ opened, there were 3,600 restaurants in San Francisco. And as of now, there are 7,600. Mm. And so you think about, in any industry, you think about that sort of an increase in competition and, you know, trying to pay fair wages and all of that. In 5 years, of course, that there's going to be damage. And basically, the other thing is customers, then they get bored really easily and they're constantly looking for that new thing. And it's just, you know, it's just sort of terrible.
Well, that's the risk, that you could be the hottest thing one day and then you're suddenly not the next. But that's not new. I mean, you know, that's not new in the restaurant world. You're saying what is new is there's just so much competition, as we said, not just from restaurants, but from apps and from food courts.
Yes, that I think is going to be something we're going to see more and more of, is the sort of food hall, the Eataly type European food halls, where you can go and get some hot Nashville chicken, or you can get some ramen, or you can get a Kobe beef burger, and they're all from different purveyors, all within a food hall. So it's not the same sort of like 90s mall food court. We're talking like upscale quality food that is all sort of in a food hall style. And I think you're going to see more and more of that because they're sharing the costs.
Hmm. You know, you compare this to what's happening in the U.S. economy in general. It's interesting because I'm thinking way, way back. It used to be that there were, you know, really fine dining restaurants that you had to get dressed up to go to. And then there were diners, you know.
Right.
But this new idea, and you know, relatively new idea in the last couple of decades, has been these really cool middle ground restaurants. If these go away, and you're saying that they will when the bubble bursts, you're back with this sort of inequity that matches the inequity that people say they see in the economy in general.
Yeah, I think that that's a fair point. I think that sort of I talk about the hollowing out of the restaurant industry center. And what's been really interesting during this, you know, golden age of restaurants is going out to dinner in your 20s and sort of like groups of guys. I know when I came out of college, which is in 2003, I lived with five guys in Boston, and we would never dream of going to a restaurant as sort of what we did socially, you know, when you're 23. But that has now become a normal, cool thing to do with these cool, casual, fine dining restaurants. So it's strange to think back and that in order to survive, these restaurants will be forced to raise prices in order to pay the fair wages, in order to pay for food costs. But it doesn't mean that we're going to see no more restaurants. I think the real movement will be away from the sit down and more towards the fast casual, towards the counter service. You're still going to have all the trappings of those cool restaurants that you're thinking of right now, but you're going to have to bust your own table.
That's Kevin Alexander. His piece in Thrillist is There's a Massive Restaurant Industry Bubble and It's About to Burst. We'll link you to his piece and his whole series on restaurants at hereandnow.org. Kevin, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
We're following the massive ice storm that's already begun in parts of the Midwest and the Plains. Storm warnings are in effect, and Missouri and Oklahoma have declared states of emergency. Dr. Greg Postel is a hurricane and storm specialist with the Weather Channel.
There may be places that get over a half of an inch of ice, which can be devastating. I mean, that can certainly bring down trees and power lines and create a real mess and make travel nearly impossible.
Meanwhile, Europe has also been experiencing bitter winter weather and sub-zero temperatures in Poland and Bulgaria. There was even heavy snow in Greece, which is very unusual. And remember, Greece is currently home to a number of refugee camps for people who have fled conflicts in Syria and elsewhere but have been unable to settle in other parts of Europe. Joining us now is the BBC's Howard Johnson, who has been in Greece visiting some of the refugee camps this week. He's with us on Skype. Howard, welcome.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, tell us where you were and what you saw in Greece.
Well, so we flew into Athens on Tuesday, and we tried to get down to the islands, tried to get down to Lesbos in particular. We took a early morning Aegean flight down to the island, but we couldn't land on it. It was absolutely covered in snow and mist. The pilot couldn't land on the runway, so we had to abort the landing, which was pretty terrifying, head back to Athens. And then we decided, well, considering we've got a day of filming ahead of us, let's try going to a camp closer to Athens. So we headed north of Athens by about 45 minutes to a place called Malakassa, and also another camp nearby called Inofita. And so we started actually at the smaller camp at Inofita. There's around 400 mainly Afghan refugees there. And when we got there, there was just blanket snow everywhere. There were tents on the right covered in snow, and there were kids everywhere just having snowball fights, having, you know, a great time. Inside one of the prefab huts, we got inside and started speaking to an NGO, a lady by the name of Lisa Campbell. She's an American lady from California. She runs a small NGO called Do Your Part. And she told us all about the problems with winterization of this camp, the need to try and make it warmer for these refugees. Now, she said that some of the bigger NGOs had not done their part. They hadn't helped to warm up the tents to help these people. So that they'd only given them a poncho, a hat, a pair of gloves, and a pair of boots, and that was it. And she said that, you know, they were really left needing more.
Well, and I wonder, is the problem that nobody ever expected the refugees to still be in these camps at this point, or that it's just so unusual to get this kind of weather in that part of Europe that nobody would have prepared the camps for winter?
Yeah, my feeling is that having spoken to a few hoteliers and Greek guys, they told us that this was a really a once in a decade event. It's not normal to have this much snow. So I think in many ways, perhaps the Greek government and maybe the NGOs were just not expecting it to be as raw and as savage as it really was. I mean, no one expected 10 inches of snow to firstly fall on the camps, but also that also affected roads and transport, which meant that affected supplies of water and food to the camps. And I don't think anyone really expected it. It really took a lot of people by surprise.
Well, let's listen to what you heard from somebody living in a camp in Thermopylae. This is a man from Aleppo, Syria. And here's what he told you.
I'm living here before 3 months. Oh, we wait because now it's winter and very cold. We have kids, we have families.
And when the winter is over, where will you go?
I don't know. Maybe we stay here in Greece and maybe we go to Germany, we go to Austria, we go to... I don't know.
How many refugees are there still in Greece right now and how long are they expected to stay there?
Well, it's thought that there are around 60,000 migrants and refugees currently in Greece. For a lot of these people, they really don't know where they're going. Some of them still think that they can get to Germany and get to Austria and do the transport route that they, you know, that we were seeing last year that was open to them. So there's a lot of confusion. People are also, for instance, that man that we spoke to there, he had actually got permission to live in Austria but had to move back to Greece or travel back to Greece with his wife because her father had health issues in Turkey. So they were trying to go back to help him out, but then had become stranded in Greece. So we're seeing this very caught between two different places, a need to want or a desire to go further into Europe, but Greece really shutting up and Macedonia shutting up the gates and saying, well, really, you can't travel further. This is where you have to stay or you go back to Turkey.
And are there more still coming at this point or has that stopped?
We heard of more crossings, yeah, from Turkey across to Lesbos and an attempt at least during the awful weather. So I would assume that it's still going to carry on.
That's the BBC's Howard Johnson, who has been visiting refugee camps in Greece where they've gotten a lot of snow in recent days. Howard, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.